Mosul calling today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. For 2 years, ISIS has controlled the Iraqi city of Mosul and isolated its residents.
They don't have any way of communication between each other. When something happened in a specific part of the city, people in another neighborhood have no idea about it.
But a radio show is trying to change that. Also, a woman in Colombia who fled her abusive husband by joining the FARC rebels.
And I went to them. All I wanted was revenge for the things he did to me. I told them what had happened.
Plus, a writer is asked to create an Asian Superman.
My immediate reaction was no. I thought that was a terrible idea. I did not want to have anything to do with it.
Why he changed his mind, ahead on the world. Today on the show, we're going to get some perspective from people in places where life can be really, really tough. Like a former Colombian rebel fighter, a woman who escaped a life of domestic abuse by joining the FARC guerrillas. So what's tough is all relative. Her story's coming up later. And in just a few minutes, what it's like to live with high levels of violence in Baghdad. Again, it's all relative because Baghdad could seem almost calm right now compared to Mosul. That northern city is under siege by the Iraqi army, which is pushing to take Mosul back from ISIS militants. And that's where we start today. My BBC colleague Jonathan Beale is following the Iraqi army's progress so far.
Last 2 weeks, they've been taking towns and villages around Mosul, and still some of those Iraqi security forces are some way off the city. But to the east, we know that their elite force, what's sometimes called the Golden Division, counterterrorism service, special forces, whatever name you like to give them, have pushed into the city limits and have taken, they say, a TV station, a state-owned TV station building where they've raised the Iraqi flag. So they are now, it appears, at the city limits, but they are meeting stiff resistance now. Remember, about between 3,000 and 5,000 so-called Islamic State fighters estimated still to be inside Mosul. And the reports that we've had from the ground is that they're meeting stiff resistance in the form of sniper fire, rocket-propelled grenades, but also IEDs and that other weapon of choice of IS, the suicide truck bomb. So they are going to take casualties.
If we look at a map of Mosul, are the assault forces coming in from different sides of the city, from different points into the city?
Yeah, when I was there just over a week ago, I was with the rapid reaction force of the Iraqi army to the south. And to be honest, it was pretty heavy going. Initial progress and then slowed down by the tactics used by IS, like suicide truck bombs I mentioned, which does cause a sense of panic amongst the forces I was with when they saw them, when they had to do a tactical withdrawal to let coalition warplanes deal with that particular threat or to use their tanks to deal with that threat. Remember, there are about 1 million people living in Mosul at the moment, estimated civilians. It's believed that some of them are being used for human shields. They've, of course, got other defenses. We know they've had 2.5 years to dig in. They've got their networks of tunnels, which they use to move around without being spotted by the coalition aircraft. They've planted IEDs. They have those suicide truck bombs. And as I said, they're also probably using human shields, civilians, to protect their positions.
I mean, it sounds like their strategy, the IS strategy in Mosul, could change radically from what we've seen so far once a lot of these troops get into the urban center of the city.
Yeah, I think it's a very different environment. When I was out there, when they were clearing those towns and village, it was essentially moving through desert, wide open spaces, easier for coalition aircraft to target things like suicide truck bombs, but also IS fighters and mortar positions. When you're in a built-up environment, the fight is going to be much more difficult because they can hide behind buildings. Mosul is their last stand. It's the last big city in Iraq under IS control. It's of totemic value because it's where Baghdadi declared his caliphate. And I think you can expect a much harder fight there.
My BBC colleague, defense correspondent Jonathan Beale. Those residents who are still in ISIS-controlled Mosul are pretty much cut off from the outside world. But there is one radio station that's managing to get some information in to them. Rebecca Collard has that story from northern Iraq.
The voice on the phone is coming from inside the city of Mosul. She speaks in hushed tones. Being caught could mean death. She asked the Iraqi government to hurry up and send troops. She promises the people of the city will support the fight against ISIS. The women will rise up, she says, even before the men. She's calling a radio station based in the Kurdish area of Iraq, one of the few media outlets that reach Mosul now. After ISIS took the city in June 2014, the militants attempted to isolate residents. They banned cell phones and the internet. More recently, they confiscated satellite dishes and TV transmitters. The radio host tells her to be strong. In March 2015, a few Mosul exiles set up this radio station, El Gad, to defy ISIS and broadcast to the people back home. El Gad means tomorrow in Arabic. Mohammed is the station manager. He doesn't want to use his last name because he's worried about the safety of his relatives inside the city. He keeps the location of the studio a secret, too.
We know how important it is to keep the people posted and to communicate with them, to be able to talk to those people and to focus on their problems and to make sure we can deliver their voices.
Calling from Mosul is difficult and extremely dangerous. ISIS has shut off many of the cell phone towers, so residents have to search for small pockets of coverage or climb to high places to get reception.
I remember in the past we used to receive very few calls from Mosul. People were scared from calling the radio station. But today, people are speaking up and they are talking. It's an average of 60 calls per day.
Mohammed says the radio is not just giving people a voice and providing information from outside. It's also helping them communicate with one another.
People are also isolated in the city itself. They don't have any way of communication between each other. So it's like the 40s or the 50s before the local lines. So sometimes when something happens in a specific part of the city, the people in another neighborhood, they will not have no idea about it.
This woman says she's calling from the left bank of the city. The host asks her what's happening there. ISIS fighters are gathering on the streets, she says. They are all young, under 30. Mohammed says he and his team are having their own battle with ISIS for the airwaves.
A week after we first broadcasted, ISIS jammed our radio station. And when we changed the frequency, probably 2 days after, ISIS jammed the new frequency. And we had that war, and it's happened up until today.
Now, El Gad has four different frequencies to ensure it's always on air, 24 hours a day and broadcasting into Mosul. Not everyone who calls is from Mosul. This man identifies himself as a member of the Iraqi security forces. Stay in your homes, he advises. Get lots of water. The host follows with advice. Stock up on supplies, put tape on the windows to stop them from shattering. Stay away from ISIS headquarters. Crucial information as Iraqi forces advance closer.
Inshallah.
God willing, says the soldier, we will liberate the city soon. For the world, Rebecca Collard, Northern Iraq.
Communication is not a problem in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, but with more than 1,000 extremist attacks per year, Baghdad is likely the world's most terrorized city. Of course, Baghdad residents also live through years of war, U.S.-led occupation, and terror attacks, so you got to wonder if anyone there could ever really get used to all the violence. Borzu Dargahi, he has a story at BuzzFeed that explores that very question. He framed his story around one bombing this summer in Baghdad's central Karada neighborhood.
You basically had a car bomb, a minivan loaded with explosives, exploding in the middle of probably the most busy shopping district in Baghdad, just after midnight during Ramadan, when people tend to stay out very late. There were two malls on either side of the street. Both of them were packed. The streets were packed. And, you know, many people died in the explosion. And then the buildings both caught on fire, and it just turned into a horrendous, horrific, really a massacre. 300 people, many of them trapped inside this building, not killed in the initial explosion, but in the horrendous fire afterward.
So
I should say,
yeah.
I should say one little thing. Like, you know, I could have very well been in Baghdad at this time, and typically kind of hang out in this particular neighborhood. So it had a real kind of impact for me.
Borzu, I think of the man you introduce us to in your story, Hakim Hasib. He's still alive after the Karada bombing, but a piece of shrapnel in his spine means that he's basically paralyzed. How are Baghdadis even able to think about the future when daily life is so unpredictable and stories of personal tragedy like Hakim's are constant reminders of how fickle fate can be in that city?
You know, I think that's a really good point. It's hard to think about the future. It's hard to invest any resources in a long-term planning. It becomes a real devastating dynamic where people lose all hope and faith in life, all drive to do anything because of the dangers that are present. You know, one thing that struck me, because a lot of people are kind of blasé about these bombings. They happen so often, happen in every single neighborhood, every type of environment, in markets, in shopping malls, in next to schools, next to roads, on your way home to work, on your way to the market, wherever they happen. And it struck me that the sort of numbness that overtakes most people when talking about these bombs is kind of similar to how the U.S. has become about mass shootings. You know, they just sort of happen so often and in so many different forums, in schools, in malls, in wherever, in parking lots, that people just sort of are immune to their effect at this point. And nothing happens whenever one of these happens. There's virtually zero consequences except for the victims. But maybe there are consequences that we don't detect so easy. Maybe it does sort of sap the will of the people and sap their hopes, each one of these bombings in Baghdad or one of these shootings in the United States.
So where does the United States fit into all of this? At the micro level, like helping out with intel to stop with attacks in Baghdad, but also at the macro level, like U.S. policy was aiming to prep the Iraqi army to get all this under control.
I think it's really the most complex set of emotions towards the U.S. in Iraq. I think, you know, it's probably akin to Japan and Germany just after World War II in some ways. Because, you know, if you look at the polls, the Iraqis say that they're very angry at the U.S., that they're very anti-American. But, you know, there's another dimension to that just beneath the surface, because they really feel like they need the Americans right now. But on a more broad level, if you talk to Iraqis, what they'll say is that, you know, the Americans share a special responsibility for what has happened in Iraq and what happens in Baghdad with these terrorist attacks. This is what the Iraqis say. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, when you talk to them a little bit more, a little bit deeper, they also very much blame themselves for not having the leadership capable of getting the country back on its feet, for their own game playing and their own sort of sectarianism and so on. And right now, what's really fascinating is, although they are still very angry at the U.S., although there is still this sort of layer of typical anti-Americanism that you see throughout the Middle East, there's a real sense of dependence on the U.S. and a real sense of relief that the U.S. is so heavily involved in the fight against ISIS.
BuzzFeed's Middle East correspondent, Borzu Dargahi. Thank you as always, Borzu.
Pleasure.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. More than 80 years ago this fall, the Long March came to an end in China. It was a big moment in the country's history and a key part of China's heroic narrative. Communist forces embarked on the Long March in 1934 to escape defeat by nationalist troops. And it was during that march that Mao Zedong emerged as the communist leader. Now a Chinese TV series produced to commemorate it has sparked a big controversy over one actress appearing in the series, Bai Ling. Ling started her acting career in China but later moved to the U.S. I asked David Wertheim for the backstory to her current news. He's senior editor at Foreign Policy.
Bai Ling had spent several weeks retracing portions of this Long March and sharing her experience on social media. She was interviewed for one of the episodes of this documentary, And a lot of the complaints online are essentially saying, well, she is not a fit figure to be part of this documentary, to be associated with this august historical event. But a lot of it goes back to this sort of sense of grievance, you know, that in 1997 in particular, she starred in a film alongside Richard Gere called Red Corner. This film did not offer the most favorable depiction of the Chinese legal system. And Chinese online users have not forgotten this.
Bai Ling actually responded to this latest reaction in China by apologizing herself on Chinese social media, which is also interesting in and of itself because I understand that Ling isn't the only Chinese celebrity of late to issue an apology for their quote-unquote anti-Chinese views, right?
No, she's not. There have been a few cases of celebrities issuing apologies. Actually, in July of just this year, a actress, Kiko Mizuhara, who's originally from Dallas, had to apologize for liking a photo on Instagram in 2013 in which dissident artist Ai Weiwei was raising a middle finger at China. More notably, perhaps, in January 2016, Chou Ziyue was essentially forced by online pressure to apologize for referring to herself as Taiwanese and waving a Taiwanese flag at a performance instead of calling herself Chinese.
Right.
And so what's interesting is this relationship between China and Hollywood is one that, you know, in the United States, folks are often rightly concerned about whether studios are, in some cases, not making creative decisions that they would otherwise make because they're worried about offending the Chinese government. But this is a reverse of that. You know, a lot of the complaints coming out of China were people saying, well, you know, this person has been sort of ruined by Hollywood and we don't want this Hollywood person in this documentary that we believe covers this essentially sacred or even holy event.
What does all this say about the growing importance of the mainland Chinese audience in dictating what is and isn't acceptable?
The power of Chinese public opinion as it affects business interests in China has only grown. The Chinese box office is the second largest in the world. That inevitably, I think, affects how stars sometimes conduct themselves. In the case of someone like Bai Ling, she's been making movies in the United States for quite some time. And in a way, the environment in which she made or starred in Red Corner is a very different one from what she's facing today. And so it's that schism that I think has come back to hurt her.
Given how China adores Hollywood productions and Hollywood now has Chinese investment in companies like Lionsgate and Imagine Entertainment, is this going to have any blowback on Bai Ling's career in Hollywood now?
That's a fantastic question. A producer looking to put together a big cross-cultural blockbuster that the state would allow to be shown on Chinese screens would certainly think about, is this star marketable in China? That introduces a business pressure that I think appears likely to grow with time.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. David Wertheim, senior editor at Foreign Policy. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Here's another actress in the middle of a controversy, Tilda Swinton, for her role in the movie Doctor Strange. In the original comic book, Swinton's character is an Asian man. The fact that a white actress got the role on screen has led to familiar complaints about the lack of diversity in Hollywood. And in this next story, we're going to talk comic books and diversity. It's about a big change for perhaps the most iconic comic book franchise. That's because there is a new Superman. Here's the world's Bradley Campbell.
You think you know Superman, right? I mean, anyone can name his traits.
Strong but silent.
He's a good man.
Superman is always like, I am good and I am noble.
But Superman was really a jerk. That's how he started anyway, back in the 1930s. And I sure as heck didn't know this. Not until DC Comics writer Gene Luen Yang told me.
He's actually kind of a bully. He's not the moral paragon that he is today. He's kind of condescending to the people around him. He likes to make fun of people for not being able to figure out his secret identity. He's really brutal to his enemies. He's not afraid of killing. And it took him a long time to become the Clark Kent that we're all familiar with.
And even in recent decades, Superman has changed a lot. In the 1980s, he was a government lackey. 90s, pure sitcom cheese. He had a moody period next, and of late, he's getting back to his golden boy self. But now, there's an even bigger change, and it's an entire reinvention and addition. DC has created a new Superman, and he's Chinese.
So he's a 17-year-old kid. His name is Kenan Kong. He's growing up in Shanghai. He inherits some of Superman's powers, some of Clark Kent's powers, and he becomes the new Superman, the Superman of China.
Now, let's be clear. This Superman does not replace Clark Kent in the DC universe. Kenan Kong is his own man. When DC made the announcement last summer, a lot of people were pumped. Others, not so much. They called it affirmative action for superheroes. And some Asian Americans were like, why do we even need this? We already got cool heroes of our own. In fact, when DC Comics asked Yang if he wanted to create this Chinese Superman, he balked.
My immediate reaction was no. I thought that was a terrible idea. I did not want to have anything to do with it.
But eventually, he agreed to at least consider the idea and attend some pitch meetings.
During those meetings, this character started talking to me. And, you know, if any writer knows that when a character starts to talk to you, you kind of have to do the project. So I ended up signing onto the project.
Yang liked the idea of Asian American kids being able to see themselves in this new character. There just haven't been that many Asian superheroes in American comic book history. Plus, Kenan Kong is a great answer to a historical wrong, one that dates back to DC's origin.
The beginning of DC Comics was Detective Comics number 1, which came out in 1937. I don't know if you've ever seen the cover of this. Have you seen this?
Never. No. What's it look like?
So the cover of DC Comics number 1 has an image of a character named Ching Lung, who is what we would recognize today as a Yellow Peril villain. He's a Chinese super genius bent on taking over the Western world. He was designed to play on the fears that America had of the Chinese at the time. And he essentially is an image that denigrates and dehumanizes an entire people group.
It's pretty awful. I actually had DC send me that cover image after the interview, and, well, yeah, it's bad. Although, looking at it makes you understand just how important this new character is.
For DC Comics to take their most iconic symbol, the S emblem, the Superman emblem, and put it on not a Chinese-American character, but a Chinese character, is a way of both apologizing for that original image, and it's also a way of showing how far we've come.
Now, that's not to say we should reject all our past, including our comic books. Yang doesn't. For there are plenty of traits the new Superman shares with the original. This one is my favorite. Kenan Kong starts out as a jerk. For The World, Bradley Campbell, Boston.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. One way we're ramping up to the election a week from today is by bringing you the stories of several first-time voters. Today, we look to the millions of U.S. citizens living in other countries. This crazy election season has motivated a lot of them to vote absentee. Manvi Singh, for example. She's 25, born in India, but grew up in California. She became a U.S. citizen 2 years ago and is voting for the first time from London, where she's a grad student now. For her, this election brings back memories of voting day in Mumbai. She's also hearing a lot of comparisons between the U.S. vote and the Brexit referendum a few months back, when a slim majority of voters in the U.K. opted to leave the European Union.
All the time I'm having conversations comparing the U.S. election to Brexit. You know, I definitely see the similarities between Brexit and sort of the discourse around Brexit, especially when it came to immigration. I also see the similarity in that both Brexit and the U.S. elections have been really divisive. And, you know, you can feel that divisiveness even now in London, you know, especially because young people in London, definitely most of them voted to stay. A lot of them are pretty bitter still about how the election turned out. And what's interesting is, like, you know, when I read U.S. news, most papers seem very confident that Hillary is going to win. And they show these big polls on, like, the front page of the New York Times and stuff showing, you know, chance of Hillary winning 80% or whatever. Here, people are much, much more skeptical. Like, one of our professors was saying, oh, like, this election, I have no idea what's going to happen. Like, it's so close. And they have this completely different impression of it, maybe colored by the fact that they had just been through Brexit. I'm really nerding out about the fact that I can vote for the first time, because this whole time, you know, I've been following U.S. politics and have not technically had, like, say in it. And now I finally get to have my say. That's really exciting. There are actually a good handful of American expats in my master's course. And I have been nagging them and hounding them and guilting them this whole time about registering and making sure they vote. I've definitely been using the first time voter thing as like a way to guilt them into being more excited. I just remember in India, my parents would always vote. And in India, you get this little blue ink stain on your thumb if you vote. That's like their version of the I voted sticker. And I would see my parents come back with those little blue ink stains that were weirdly impossible to wash away for weeks. And they would be so like pumped about it, you know, and I think that's affected my own enthusiasm for being able to vote in the U.S. now.
First time voter Manvi Singh telling us her story from London. Another group of first-time voters has been making headlines this election cycle, Puerto Ricans. As you may know, Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens by birth, but they can't vote in the general election unless they're living on the mainland. That law is the same for almost all residents of U.S. territories, with some exceptions. The World's Maria Muriel is in the studio with me now to talk about this. She's been covering the election all year, and most recently, she's been looking at the voting laws for territory residents. So, U.S. citizens, Maria, in territories, they can't vote for president in the general?
Not in the general, but they can vote in the primaries. When I was at the Republican and Democratic National Conventions this summer, delegates from Puerto Rico, American Samoa, Guam, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and the Northern Mariana Islands were there at the convention. So the parties court these territory voters during the primaries, but then they can't participate in the general unless they move to the mainland.
Now, that doesn't really seem fair. You're an American citizen, but you can't vote.
Well, you can't vote from home. And, you know, a lot of these territories are very far away, like Guam, American Samoa. Puerto Rico's closer, right? But it still involves a plane ticket and getting here and establishing residency. And all of that is costly.
Right. And it means not just flying somewhere to vote. It means actually, as you said, setting up residence somewhere else, and that you've got to be really committed to the idea of voting. So are people angry about this in places like Puerto Rico and Guam?
I spoke specifically with people from American Samoa, and yes, they are angry because here's the other thing. People from American Samoa are U.S. nationals, not U.S. citizens.
What's the difference?
So every other resident of the territories is a U.S. citizen by birth, and this allows them to vote when they move to the mainland. But American Samoans, there's something on their passport that says this is not a U.S. citizen, this is a U.S. national. And that means when they move to the mainland, if they want to, they have to apply for naturalization as if they were immigrants. So this involves a $680 naturalization fee and a citizenship test, which some American Samoan voting rights activists have been comparing to a poll tax, which is outlawed by the Constitution.
Maria, just to orient us and remind us, where is American Samoa?
American Samoa is in the South Pacific, just west of French Polynesia. And there's a big American military presence there. And people from American Samoa are big on enrolling in the military because it offers a lot of benefits that maybe they couldn't have otherwise.
At some point, didn't Washington, D.C. residents also not have the right to vote?
Yeah. So what happened there was a constitutional amendment was passed to grant D.C. residents the right to vote. And this is what the American Samoan activists that I spoke to want. They just, you know, want another amendment to the Constitution that allows them to be citizens or at least allows them to vote in the general election the way people from other territories can.
Does that mean at some point that, you know, American Samoa, other territories, they're going to be They're going to want statehood?
This varies. So I've spoken to a lot of Puerto Ricans who, yes, would like statehood. Some other Puerto Ricans would like outright independence for Puerto Rico to be a country. One of the American Samoan activists that I spoke to says that actually in American Samoa, there's an opposition to statehood and other kinds of more direct, I guess, or clear U.S. sovereignty because they're afraid that that would dispose them of their current sovereignty on the island. But these activists are upset because that island has some of the highest military enrollment rates, but then those people can't choose their commander in chief.
Do you have any numbers on how many of these residents of these territories have actually moved so they can vote?
I know that there is a large community in California. The activist I spoke to was based in Southern California, and he says there's a big community there. A lot of them are veterans, a lot of them are seniors, and a lot of them also have lost sons and daughters in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and they want to be able to participate in this election, but, you know, a lot of them haven't been able to naturalize.
A lot of different rules here. Thanks very much for walking us through all of them, Maria.
Thank you, Marco.
And if you were busy keeping up with a lot of the interesting details in that story, you can read more about it at PRI.org. This election has been so different from any before it in so many ways. One of them is the amount of anti-Muslim rhetoric that we're all hearing. The Southern Poverty Law Center has just published a list of people it says are the worst offenders. But as The World's Matthew Bell reports, the list itself has sparked some controversy.
The list is really for people like me, people in the news business looking for experts to put on the air. The Southern Poverty Law Center wants to make it clear that the 15 names on this new list are people with extreme anti-Muslim views. Mark Potok is a senior fellow with the SPLC in Montgomery, Alabama.
There are an awful lot of people out there who present themselves as quote-unquote experts on terrorism or on Islam, who really are people who make it their business simply to savage Islam.
One of them is Pamela Geller. She led the campaign in 2010 against building an Islamic center in Lower Manhattan. She's described by the SPLC as, quote, probably the best known and the most unhinged anti-Muslim ideologue in the United States. But a couple of other names on the list are raising eyebrows. In particular, there's Majid Nawaz. He's a British Muslim writer and activist and a self-declared former jihadist. The SPLC describes Nawaz as a self-promoting hypocrite. But Mark Potok says the bottom line is that Nawaz has accused peaceful Muslim groups of being connected somehow to Islamic extremism.
We think that Nawaz is very wrong-headed and under the appearance of sort of only attacking radical Islam, in fact, is attacking Islam in general.
But Nawaz has his defenders. They say he stands up for his fellow Muslims and calls out the real extremists. Jamie Kirchick is a fellow at the Foreign Policy Initiative, a conservative think tank in Washington.
Majid Nawaz is himself a Muslim. He's a liberal in the greatest sense of the term. He believes in individual rights and freedom, and he believes in a liberal interpretation of Islam that condemns terrorism, that respects the human rights of all people, including non-believers or ex-believers. And I think he's one of the strongest voices for liberalism within Islam.
Kirchick takes issue with another name on the SPLC's list, and that's Ayan Hirsi Ali. She's a Somali-born, former Muslim who's been unreserved in her criticism of Islam. The question is, do Ali and Nawaz belong on a list with Pamela Geller? Kirchick says putting out lists like this one is really a distraction.
We're losing perspective. I abhor Pam Geller and what she says and what she stands for. But Pam Geller's never tried to kill anybody. People have tried to kill Pam Geller. People have tried to kill Ayan Hirsi Ali. Majid Nawaz, his life is going to be in more danger now thanks to this list that SPLC put out. I think we should really be focusing on who is threatening people's lives with violence. It's not the people that I've just mentioned. It's Islamic extremists.
Nawaz himself says he's got a target on his head. In a robust self-defense in the Daily Beast, Nawaz writes that nothing good ever comes from compiling lists. He accuses the SPLC of McCarthyist tactics, but Omid Safi is not buying any of it.
Someone like Majid Nawaz is, I would say, he's a very complicated person.
Safi is the director of the Islamic Studies Center at Duke University. He says the SPLC's list of anti-Muslim extremists helps expose bigotry and that Nawaz's name belongs on it too.
It's not so much that Majid Nawaz hates Islam or that he hates all Muslims. It is that he actually has a very specific agenda, and it's an agenda that actually fosters the process of doing surveillance, not on the basis of what people have done, but on the basis of who they are, ethnically and religiously, and that just violates our entire legal norm.
Nawaz was widely criticized for a private 2010 memo he sent to the British government, where he named several British Muslim groups as sharing the ideology of extremists. Critics say this kind of thing has the effect of casting suspicion on Muslims in general. But Nawaz argues that he's opposed to ethnic and religious profiling. He says he's standing against extremism by calling for reform from within the Muslim community. The editorial page of the Wall Street Journal has come out in support of Majid Nawaz and Ayaan Hirsi Ali, calling both of them Muslim reformers. There's also a change.org petition for both of their names to be removed from the SPLC's list. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Following the attempted coup in Turkey last July, the government there began to detain suspected coup plotters in the military. Then they fired university professors, arrested many of them as well, also school teachers and journalists. That trend continues. This past weekend, officials detained the editor and a dozen staffers of Turkey's oldest secular newspaper. But the remaining journalists of the paper are not backing down.
The paper is still coming out. Today it came out with the headline, "We Will Not Surrender."
That's my BBC colleague Selin Girit in Istanbul. She went over to the newspaper's offices today.
There have been crowds gathered at the premises shouting, "We will be shoulder to shoulder against fascism," because they hold the government responsible of this crackdown. High-profile staff members of this newspaper have been detained, and for 5 days they will not be allowed to see their lawyer even under the emergency decrees. At least 170 media outlets have been shut down. Over 100 journalists have been arrested, so it looks rather grim.
Would you say the government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is extremely sensitive right now to any language that might somehow give some legitimacy to the coup?
Well, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is not someone known for his tolerance towards criticism. He has sued thousands of people for their criticisms against him, famously a German journalist, a German satirist as well, for citing a poem criticizing Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The thing is, Cumhuriyet is one of the few remaining opposition papers in Turkey. This is a very prestigious investigative paper. And although it is not, of course, a secret that they have been critical of Mr. Erdogan and the government, they were on the opposition side. They are journalists, the journalism organizations say, and it is not fair to try journalists because of the journalism they do.
The remaining journalists at Cumhuriyet, what are they saying and thinking, and are they still trying to put the paper out?
They are defiant. They say they want to carry on doing their job, but they're, of course, fearful, concerned about what might happen next.
I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. The numbers are so huge. Early on after the coup, 37,000 people arrested and more than 100,000 dismissed since the coup or suspended from government jobs. Do these people have any recourse?
They are finding it difficult to find lawyers to represent them. So fair trial is of concern to these people.
So Selin, I want to ask you about some other story here in Turkey. The co-mayors of Diyarbakir, the largest Kurdish majority city in Turkey, have been detained and the municipality has been taken over by a trustee. I read that one of those mayors was charged with assisting terrorists. What can you tell us?
So of course, these co-mayors were elected by the people of Diyarbakir. The government says they are affiliated with the Kurdish militant group PKK, but both deny having any direct involvement with this group. What the Kurdish population fears at the moment is this crackdown actually will continue in the southeast of the country where predominantly Kurds live, and other municipalities will be taken over by appointing trustees in those places as well.
Sounds like there's concern everywhere in Turkey right now.
Many people across Turkey are concerned this polarization could even deepen further and darker days could be ahead.
My BBC colleague Selin Girit in Istanbul, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Why do women go to war and what happens to them when they come back? Two of the many questions being asked in Colombia as the country looks for a way to end its long civil war. Voters rejected a peace deal in a referendum last month, but there is a ceasefire and talks continue between the Colombian government and leftist rebels. If a lasting peace is achieved, an estimated 17,000 guerrillas are expected to demobilize. About 40% are women. There's a U.S.-funded program that's already helping some former rebels to transition back to civilian life. The World's Jasmine Garst, with our Across Women's Lives team, traveled to Colombia to meet some of them. Today, Jasmine introduces us to one former rebel who faces an uphill struggle, but is excited to start a new life.
By the time Nelcy Soto managed to make it out of the house, her husband had already disfigured her face. She had tried running away before, but he always managed to find her and bring her back. This time, she had some help.
Mi hermano me dijo, váyase, váyase.
My brother told me, leave, leave. Leave your children and go.
She headed for the mountains. She was in pain, but she knew this terrain like the palm of her hand.
Con mis padres, pues, sembrar maíz.
Well, my parents and I cultivated corn, yucca, plantain. We grew coffee, everything. I've loved the countryside since I was a kid.
She has good memories of her childhood, but that ended when she was 14. That's when one of her brothers secretly sold her to a nearby landowner in exchange for a small plot of land. Nelcy's mother eventually found her, but the man had already raped her. And in rural Colombia at the time, that meant one thing.
My mom said, no, I can't take you back. He's your owner now. You have to live with him. He treated me like a dog, and I became enraged with men. I lived almost 10 years with him. I had 4 children with him. When he wasn't around, I would grab this little machete and go whack around the mountain to let out the rage of seeing myself there, a prisoner, with no one to help me.
It's hard to picture anyone laying a hand on Nelcy. There's a toughness to her, the way she sneers her chuckles, the way she stands with her thick torso puffed out and her fists balled. But he did lay a hand on her. He did it all the time. And then one day he hurt her so bad, her brother told her to run, and she did, straight to the FARC.
And I went to them. All I wanted was revenge for the things he did to me. I told them what had happened.
Like a lot of Colombians I speak to, Nelcy never refers to the Revolutionary Armed Forces by name. She only says ellos, them, the leftist guerrillas who had been locked in decades of war with the government. Nelcy had spent enough time angrily swinging her machete in the mountains to know where they were. The FARC kicked her husband off his land and took Nelcy in, and that's how she became a guerrilla fighter.
In areas under FARC's territorial control, they administered justice.
Professor Kimberly Tyden teaches international humanitarian studies at Tufts University. She's done extensive work in Colombia, and she says a lot of women do enter the FARC for ideological reasons, but many also go to the guerrilla group for protection and justice.
Now, we may not think it was justice as we would define it, but for, you know, cattle rustling, for husbands who were beating wives, for abusive relationships, people would go to the guerrilla in hope that they would do something to help them extract revenge, bring the violence to an end, etc.
Nelcy felt safe in the mountains.
It was a good time. I mean, sometimes you suffer sleeping out there, but it's a good time. You have a new family.
Nelcy spent her 5 years with the FARC mostly smuggling supplies from the city to the mountains. It wasn't until she got word that her mother was sick that she left. She moved to Florencia, a city on the edges of the Colombian Amazon, to be with her. She enrolled in the government program, which reintegrates militants like her back into society. It can take 6 years and starts with a halfway house and psychological support. There's a stipend for people who enroll in education or vocational training. Nelcy, for example, started learning how to extract rubber from trees. When I meet her, she's at the very end of the program. In a few days, she'll be done. I visit her small house at the top of a hill in one of those neighborhoods made up of shacks piled upon shacks held up by improvisation and prayer. She hates how crowded it is here. But this place gave her this freedom she didn't even know what to do with at first. Suddenly, she didn't belong to a man or even an armed group. She hesitates before telling me this next part about how she met someone when she first arrived.
I got here and I met her. I worked as a waitress. She sold coffee in the park.
They got to know each other.
I'd ask myself, why is this happening? Why do I like her?
And they fell in love.
How does it work? Like, how do you make it work?
Over time, she became more comfortable in her own skin and came out as a lesbian. Now she lives with her girlfriend and her kids. In a few days, when she's graduated from the program, she wants to take them all back to the countryside.
Y más que todo, la ciudad es muy pesada, muy dura para uno vivir.
The city feels heavy. In the countryside, I feel so much calmer. But it's been, oh man, 7 or 8 years since I haven't been back to the countryside. All this time, I've been enrolled in reintegration.
Nelsie wants to go home, but where is that? Is it the place where her own family sold her off? Is it the land belonging to the man who bought her and brutalized her? Is it in the mountains with the armed group that took her in? The truth is, she doesn't have a home or any land to call her own. A recent peace agreement pledged to help women like Nelsie get their own land, but that agreement fell apart. Professor Tyden says moving forward, no peace process can really work if the former rebels don't have a place to call their own.
Land is a feminist issue. Women having rights to own it, to inherit it, to work it, to profit from it. This is a feminist issue. And until we figure out how to do a better job of that in Colombia, then we also have to ask, what again, what are people and women going back to when they go back to rural areas?
But many here feel that's asking for a lot. After all, the FARC is responsible for thousands of killings, kidnappings, disappearances. People like Nelsie, they'd argue, who joined a guerrilla organization which terrorized the nation, deserve nothing but punishment. But with the peace deal in limbo and the war not necessarily over, a lot of Colombians, Nelsie included, just want to get on with their lives.
El sábado madrugamos para la finca. Ya nos desplazamos de la ciudad.
On Saturday, we're going to the countryside. We're leaving the city.
She's beaming as she says this. She's going to put her new skills to use at a rubber tree plantation, a booming industry in Colombia these days. She says the work shouldn't be too tough. The pay is okay. She's betting on the landowner not minding her being gay. She says, I'll have to stop by someday for some sancocho, homemade stew. For The World, Jasmine Garst, Colombia.
Later this week, Jasmine explores why, despite all the pain, so many Colombians feel it's time to move on. And that is our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Thank you for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.